Greetings, programs. You are listening to The Bigfoot Show, episode 054, released on or about the 22nd of September, 2013. The title of this episode, Further Adventures in the Land Called X, is, I will admit, somewhat misleading. It is indeed a furthering of the accounts of experiences members of the North American Wood Ape Conservancy have had as they conducted their work this past summer in a remarkable little corner of the Washington Mountain Range. It is, as you probably already know, called X by the group. You will hear some astonishing things. Possibly you will find some of these things to be unbelievable. As always, you have my assurances that everything you hear is true. I know these guys, and crazy as some of them may sound, this is true. But no, the show is not actually about random Bigfoot encounters in X. It's actually about a group of dedicated individuals going about the work they feel is necessary to bring Bigfoot out into the light of science and reality. In short, this is about collecting the wood ape holotype. Members of the NAWAC have not been shy about their intention to collect as complete a wood ape specimen as possible. However, this is the first time you'll hear about what that endeavor is actually like. It's not, as you'd probably expect, easy work. Now, you either agree with the point of view of the NAWAC or you don't. Regardless, the position of the group and the thing that drives them can be summed up by explaining what's called the 5500 rule of conservation biology. Basically, about 50 individuals of a particular animal need to be present in any given area to prevent a destructive rate of inbreeding. If these 50 are cut off from more of their kind or the last of their kind, their chances of survival are questionable. Around 500 individuals are required to maintain an acceptable level of genetic variation. Numbers lower than that can make the animal susceptible to being sucked into the terrifyingly named extinction vortex. The extinction vortex is a series of models used by biologists to understand and predict animal extinction rates. Besides genetic diversity, other factors include habitat pressures and habitat fragmentation. Of course, no one knows for sure how many apes there are in the Washitas, or North America for that matter, but we know that the region has been and continues to be harvested of trees using practices to promote the development of monoculture forests. We know that the relatively untouched areas of the range are becoming fewer and farther between. When applying that knowledge to what we understand about large primates worldwide, and the group's own observations of wood ape behavior over the past several years, we would expect Bigfoot to be social animals that live in groups inhabiting established territories. Each group, whatever its social structure, would require a finite amount of land upon which to thrive. Some of the big unknowns is how big is that territory? Are monoculture environments acceptable wood ape habitat? How many eligible areas are left in that part of the country? In short, are there less than 50 apes left? Or more than 500, or somewhere in between? And do they know where they can find more of their kind? Essentially, how many factors found in the extinction vortex are already at work and affecting wood ape populations? The NAWAC feels the only way to know how many apes there are in X, or how many X's there are in the Washitas, or the Ozarks, or the Sierras, or the Olympics, or anywhere, is to put qualified and numerous boots on the ground to find out. The only way to put those boots on the ground is to establish as an absolute fact that there's an actual animal to be protected. The most efficient and expeditious way to establish as an absolute fact that the animal exists is to collect a specimen. There are more than a few people in the community of Sasquatch enthusiasts who feel the best course is to leave these animals alone. They've been just fine all by themselves so far, and they'll be just fine in the future. But that train of thought is tantamount to putting a bag over your head as a way to better understand the world around you. All one has to do is look at a satellite map of any wild and woolly area in North America to see how truly wild and secluded parts of it are under constant pressure. They're shrinking. If you think this situation is tolerable to an animal like Sasquatch, you might as well ask yourself how many can be balanced on the head of a pin. I suppose we could wait for an acceptable DNA sample to be collected and confirmed, or for an unsuspecting Bigfoot to step in front of a logging truck with bad brakes, or for an old portly one to succumb to cardiovascular disease while raiding a campground dumpster. But nothing like that has happened in more than 50 years of looking, and, at least in my opinion, it's unlikely to happen in the near future. So we can either keep waiting and hoping to get lucky and pretending like the animal we're talking about here has all the time in the world, or we can show some initiative and try to protect them and their habitat sooner, perhaps tomorrow. And that's what the NAWAC is working towards today. What follows is a series of interviews I conducted at the recently concluded NAWAC member retreat. First up, you'll hear from Alton Higgins and Daryl Collier, the group's chairman and field operations coordinator, respectively. Then you'll hear from Paul Bowman as he relates his experiences surrounding a daylight sighting of a probable wood ape. Then it'll be Brad McAndrews and Jordan Horseman talking about their time in a hunting blind the group calls Overwatch. Finally, we'll hear from Travis Lawrence. He's the man who's come the closest of all within the NAWAC to establishing the North American wood ape as fact. Well, gentlemen, here we are again, almost a little more than a year later than we were last year. Same room, though, talking about the NAWAC's now annual retreat. Alton, what's the point of this event for us as an organization?
The point is to decompress, to discuss, to plan, strategize, and just to have a good time with each other. I think one of the great strengths of our group is that we like each other, and now we hear music in the background.
That's a cell phone. It's all right. I'm going to pay some royalties or something for whatever the song that is.
Yeah, I think it's very important for us to get together like this and visit. And you got it taken care of over there?
This is the Bigfoot Show. We don't do seconds. This is awesome. Daryl, you gave a presentation today that sort of a recap of the recently concluded operation. Can you give us some highlights? Just what are some of the things that were of note in your mind?
Well, as with last year, we went over what we call 19 quantitative events. Those are things that we track, behavioral things that we track. And there seemed to be a sense, at least I had the sense, that some of our investigators had this notion that perhaps there was a de-escalation. And the data that we compiled for today's retreat clearly indicates that that there's nothing of the sort going on. In fact, what we're witnessing is just a continual escalation of behavior. More rock throwing, more wood knocking, the visuals, it just continues. It's just on an upward trajectory over the last 3 years. And it's just truly incredible. And, if I were not a part of this organization, it would be very difficult for me to believe. And so I understand anybody's skepticism about all this. I truly do.
So one of the reasons we haven't sort of what they would say normalized the data, we spent a lot more time. If you compare Operation Endurance, which was the first sort of long-term operation, versus Operation Relentless, how many days were we in there this year for Relentless?
Operation Relentless was in total 107 days long.
107 days.
Yeah, we had it was 83 days, 83 consecutive days before we had a small gap between two teams. We were there for 83 days without cessation, and then there was a gap of 2 days, maybe 1 day. We had another team, a couple of days, and then we went for 2 weeks. So, but in total, Operation Relentless this summer's prolonged field study was 107 days with 17 field teams. Yeah.
We were joking because we were talking about sort of the roots of these long-term operations. And when Endurance was first proposed, it was a 30-day operation. We were like, how are we going to pull off 30 days, right? Well, we just did 107, which absolutely blows my mind. Do you know how many members that is over the 17? Do you have any idea?
I think we're talking about 35. Around 35 participants. And, of course, some of us were on several teams.
Oh, sure.
But it was absolutely a team effort. And, it's a great testament to the cohesion of the North American Wood Ape Conservancy and the dedication of these people. If they take time off from work, their families, and they come out and they spend weeks out here. And it's, a very inhospitable environment. And researching this thing. And my hat's off to every last one of them.
So two of the things we did this year that were different from previous years is we invested a lot in technology. Let's talk about the first piece of technology, which is the security system. Alton, why did we invest in this thing, and what did you think we would get out of it this year?
Well, we were hoping to get some video footage from these security cameras from the system. We installed a system at pretty considerable expense that basically had, I think, 9 cameras and a 360-degree view around the cabin It was all recorded to a DVR whenever the system was running. So that was our objective, because the previous years we've had experiences where the creatures came into close range, either to slap the building or to do what they called the rock rain or something like that.
Where, or looking to the windows.
Where, yeah, right. Coming up to windows, yeah. The rock rain thing was played for us today. Parts of it, some of the recordings that they had of that are pretty remarkable, where it's just a continuum. I mean, you can hear rocks hitting the building just by the hundreds. And
Whoa. Okay. I'm just going to interrupt Alton here for a second, because some of you may not know what the rain of rocks is that he's talking about. I've actually put this in the show before, but since he's talking about it again, I will intercut a couple of minutes of this bizarre behavior. Now, some people will say, oh, you hear the rocks coming down. Why don't you jump out of bed and run outside and see what's throwing them? And I say jump out of bed because they almost always happen very, very early in the morning. And the reason we don't do that is, we have tried that, actually. You get up out of bed, you step on the floor of the cabin. The cabin is old and creaky. And amazingly enough, as soon as you start moving around, the rocks stop. When you go outside, there's nothing to see. So when this was recorded, we actually specifically did not get out of bed because we wanted to hear what would happen. We wanted to hear the rocks, and we wanted to hear how long they would go. So there's a little bit of that you're going to hear, and then we'll jump back into Alton mid-sentence.
So we thought, you have to be close to throw little rocks like that, or nuts, or whatever it was that they were throwing, and these other, you know, coming up to the windows and looking in the windows and beating on the building. I mean, those all entail close approaches. So we thought, well, let's put up the security system so we can, you know, get video of them, document them approaching the cabin. So that was the idea.
Sounds like a good plan. How did it work out, Daryl?
Huge disappointment. And that's an understatement. We were very disappointed. We thought there might be some problems with it. I mean, we discussed that.
Yeah, you and I talked about
it. Absolutely. You, Brian, you and I had discussed the possibility of whether it would work, and we thought we had an obligation to try it. Like Alton said, nine high-dollar cameras, surveillance cameras with infrared that could see in a complete darkness out to 100 feet with a DVR system powered by 8 bulldozer batteries with solar panels, a number like half dozen solar panels. It was an ambitious system, and as you and I discussed, it was something we had to try. We were obligated to try it because, you know, as Alton said, we had things coming up to the cabin. People are asking, well, why can't you get pictures of them? Why can't you get photographs, footage? Okay. So we invested heavily in this system. We deployed it, and you and I had some reservations. We had our history with game cameras. We know that game cameras and these things, there's some sort of inverse relationship. They, for whatever reason, avoid them. They don't like them. So we thought there might be something like that along with these surveillance cameras. As it turns out, I think our intuition was correct. We got no footage of any wood apes, none, during Operation Relentless. It seemed like whenever we turn the system on, and each camera, when you turn it on, you can see there's like a small red little light.
That's the IR, right?
Yeah, it's the infrared. And so if their visual acuity is heightened, you know, even 50% higher than ours, then you know they're going to be able to see that red light. And
well, it got to the point where we started to view the security system as sort of a wood ape shield. You know, if we turned it on, we would perceive a marked difference in behavior, and we could turn the cameras on to actually, because we had guys in there by themselves, and when they felt that they were being a little, you know, encroached upon, they would flip on the system, and that would sort of solve the problem. So our thinking at this point is something to do with the fact that the IR is not invisible.
Yeah, I think Kathy Strain, you know, posited that perhaps it's even blinding to them. You know, if they can see so much better than we can, if their eyes are so much better than they bring in so much more light, then who knows? I mean, yeah, maybe these things are just like bright beacons to them, and for whatever reason, I think it's discernible. I think there was no doubt in most of our minds that with those cameras going, that behavior would just cease, and so we got to where we stopped running it.
Right.
We just turned it off. We left it off, and then everything went through the roof.
Well, because you're given the choice between having a security system, a surveillance system that could record, you know, endless hours of, you know, trees, versus getting the animal to come in close as it has been in the past. We chose the interaction.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So we spent a lot of money on it, but we were obligated to try it. We did try it. It was very much a disappointing system. So we're going to get rid of it.
Right. Basically, it's an asset, so we're going to basically recycle it into another asset, which kind of gets us to the reason why we didn't want the if the surveillance system was, in fact, keeping the wildlife away, the reason we wanted them to get close was the second piece of significant investment that we made last year, which was what?
We bought some thermal equipment, some thermal optics, rifle scopes, handheld thermal scopes, which significantly upped our game. And connected with that, we devised a way to observe during the night and remain totally hidden. We used a tent. We constructed a tent out of black plastic trash bags. Thermal optics will see through thin layers of black plastic trash bags like they're not there. So we took a canopy tent that had a roof to it and had four legs, and then around the walls we used duct tape and we put black plastic trash bags all around the walls. And then two of our guys would go in there overnight and conduct what we call overwatch. We call it the overwatch tent. And
so the environment in there, so the idea is that it's black tent, and our assumption was that wood apes would view that as any other tent, any other sort of temporary structure. Now, when you're inside, talk to me about what it's like inside the overwatch tent while you're performing the duty of overwatch, because it's not the friendliest environment in the world.
Actually, I think it takes a certain mentality, because it's very claustrophobic.
Right.
You can't see unless you hold the thermal up to your eye or the rifle with the thermal scope on it. You can't see. You're just in. It's four walls, black walls, and so it can be, if you let it get to you mentally, it can be very debilitating,
right.
Claustrophobic. You know, it can make some people a little crazy.
Yeah.
Other people who can maintain that that mental discipline, for me it was not a problem. For Travis, it wasn't a problem. For McAndrews, wasn't a problem for us. I mean, it was just like throwing a fish in a fishbowl and letting him swim. I mean, we loved it, and we just ate that stuff up. And we'd get in there, and we'd spend hours at a time and just eating it up, because nothing knew you were watching. You were sitting in this overwatch tent with these thermal optics, watching everything.
We actually observed quite a bit of wildlife, not the wildlife we were hoping all the time, but I mean, we saw all kinds of animals. There was one particular animal early on that we saw that we were very surprised about. You know what I'm talking about? It went under the cabin?
Yeah, the duck. Yeah, I saw it. I saw the duck. Yeah, I heard the quacks. And then Travis, he was my overwatch partner.
Visually identified.
Yeah, he saw the duck under the porch.
Right.
And then the Overwatch tent was set up so that it could provide Overwatch for the cabin, for our base camp cabin. And so, yeah, so we had 24, we had hours, we had eyes on the cabin 24/7. And so you got two guys in this Overwatch tent, and the rest of your team is in the cabin sleeping. Are there in tents, regular tents? And so we've got a history knowing that these things approach tents, they approach the cabin. So that's what Overwatch was built for, and it was extremely successful. We did see the target species a number of times while we were on Overwatch, and very, very fascinating. I still believe Overwatch and thermal optics mounted on rifles, I believe that is the ticket. That will eventually pay off. Came very close to paying off this year. And, you know, we'll talk about that a little later.
Yeah. I'm going to talk to Travis, who had probably he's the one who had the experience you're talking about. So, Alton, you were part of the very last team in this year's operation. And you and Daryl were the first to arrive for that last team. And the sort of pause between that team and the previous one, about 2 weeks. You guys pulled up at night. What did you find there in camp?
Yeah, we pulled up to the property gate, which was locked, and we hiked in to get a key to let ourselves into the property. And it was pitch black. We first made kind of a little round of the property. We didn't go directly to the cabin, but when we did arrive at the cabin, we saw the Overwatch tent basically destroyed. It was just completely broken, smashed flat. Pushed over. Daryl said, you know, I thought something like this might happen. You know, it'd been a couple of weeks between our arrival and the last team, and last year we had a similar kind of event happened where we had a very large teepee that Paul brought in, and there was a two-week break. That teepee had been there basically all summer. I'd slept a lot of nights in that teepee, and then they came back after 2 weeks last summer, and the teepee, a lot of the stakes had been pulled up and broken, and I mean, I didn't see that. I wasn't there for that. But Daryl said, you know, I had a feeling that something like this might happen.
You know, what I find interesting is this structure, the Overwatch tent, was not, it was just sort of put together. But it had been there through an entire Oklahoma summer. I mean, there had been storms that had come through. We think at one point there may have been a funnel cloud over the cabin where we are. So there had been heavy rain. There had been heavy wind. And that thing was a trooper the whole time. And you guys come in, and it's flattened. And so describe to me the condition of it. It didn't look like it had been blown over. What did you perceive? What kind of damage did you see on it? What did you think happened by looking at it?
Yeah, it wasn't blown over. It was broken. It looked like it had been pounded from above and then pushed away towards the east. It had been pounded like on the west side. And we saw a place where it looked like a large hand had been punched through the side. You could see clear marks that looked like they were fingers and a thumb and a large hole that had been kind of pressed down. And we found also inside of it a rock that may have been thrown, a large rock. So anyway, the black plastic was kind of stretched out in front of it, and we also saw on top of it what looked to be like possible big muddy footprints. Daryl smelled a strong smell of urine around.
So these damn dirty apes came over, and they busted up our tent, and then they peed on it. Is that what you think happened?
That's exactly what I think happened, and I was extremely angry when I saw it. Yeah. You know, because last year, like we said, the teepee, It was the same time period. When last year, when the team came in for Labor Day to finish up Operation Persistence, we found the teepee destroyed. The plastic stakes had been broken in half, many of them, and ripped out of the ground. The tent was about halfway torn down. So going into this year's Labor Day, we had another gap of about 10 or 12 days. And so I thought, okay, I'm wondering if they got to that Overwatch tent. And sure enough, when Alton and I walked in there, it was the first thing I looked at. I said, Alton, look. And I remember distinctly Alton goes, whoa.
I broke out my camera. I broke out my iPhone and started videoing it, shining my flashlight on it as I was using my phone's video function. And so I was recording away and looking at the different broken sections of it and what have you. And then all of a sudden, like a cannon, just we heard this huge, loud bam! And Daryl just, he just went off on the thing. And we went
so what was that bam? What was it?
Well, I mean, it sounded like a large rock hitting metal.
Right.
Metal, yeah.
Yeah, it hit the cabin, or right behind the cabin. There's a metal thing right behind the cabin, so it either hit that or the cabin. It startled us. I mean, because we're looking at this Overwatch tent that's been destroyed. We've only been there a few minutes, and then all of a sudden we hear this thing. It sounds like a stick of dynamite going off, and I was already angry. So it made me even more angry because this thing throws a rock, and, you know, I mean, just, yeah, it was got pretty loud at that point and went after it to the best I could. And of course, you can't chase them. Right. We know that. Right. But still, sometimes you get into it and you want to chase them. Right. You know,
we went to the mountain, shined our lights up there, and looked as best we could. Not too many minutes after that, I mean, we mentioned this on the tape too. I still had my camera running, and we heard off to the east a real loud thump, like a rock hitting the ground, something like that. And so we figured that was related. It was a perfectly calm night. You know, there was no wind or anything like that.
It was obvious to me that this Overwatch tent was the subject of aggression. There was some frustration, aggression, whatever you want to call it. I think these things took out some frustration and aggression on this Overwatch tent because of some things that transpired earlier in the summer. That's what I believe. You know, that's speculation. Yeah, I don't have any facts to back it up. And other people might be saying, well, how do you know it wasn't a bear? Well, there were no claw marks, no teeth marks. It wasn't eaten. It wasn't chewed. It wasn't, there was none of that. I mean, in the big hole, it looks like a big human or human-like or ape hand actually punched through. And Alton talked about how we found a huge rock. And when we say huge, I mean, it was at least a foot and a half long by a foot wide, this rock was, that had been thrown to the northwest corner of the Overwatch tent. So, I mean,
and that hadn't been in there because you guys have been in there all summer long, and there are smaller rocks in the dirt. I mean, it's an uneven surface, but not a rock like that.
Right. I said all summer, I thought that the apes knew that something was up with the Overwatch tent. I'm not going to say they knew we were in there up watching them, but I think they didn't like it. They would see us go in there, and they didn't know what we were doing in there. And then some things happened, which you're going to talk about later with Travis and Jordan and some of the other guys and McAndrews. You're going to talk to them. I mean, a lot of the key events of Operation Relentless took place because of the Overwatch tent. So I think that's key.
One of the reasons we speculated earlier that we had so much more data. Well, we had recorded so many more activities, such as the wood knocks and the vocalizations and the rocks, is because we were up more. Because we had guys in the Overwatch tent for so much. I mean, so almost some of this could be just that we recorded more data because we were awake more than we had been in the past. So we don't have an Overwatch tent anymore. So we're going to have to do this all again next year. How do you, with in relation to the security system, which we've decided now to sort of recycle into other equipment, what are we going to do differently next year?
I think, as I said, our mission, our objective is going to be accomplished through the use of thermal technology and Overwatch. So that's what we're going to focus on next year. We're going to procure more thermal technology, and we're going to construct a better Overwatch structure from which to conduct Overwatch. In fact, we may even have a mobile Overwatch structure as well. So, so that's what we're looking at.
And we've had this conversation, you and I, just personally, but also as a larger group. What I find heartening after this, even though it is the end of a long summer, and we did not accomplish the objective of the organization at this point, it feels to me like it's just a matter of time. We now know how to do it. We figured it out. We know how it's going to happen. And when I have this conversation with Travis in a few minutes, I think it'll become clear. But this is how it's going to happen.
Yeah, you brought up the phrase in our conversation earlier in the week that, you know, we are cracking the code. I love that phrase because I think that is highly appropriate. We are cracking the code. They do use some form of communication, and I'm not talking about verbal communication, but I'm talking about wood knocking and rocks and clicks and pops, and we're figuring that out. We can't exactly speak it, but we've learned to hear it and identify it. We are cracking that code, and I agree with you. We are very close, very, very, very close. And I can't help but believe next year is going to be it for sure.
All right, now I'm with Paul Bowman, and Paul had finally had what was probably a daylight visual sighting. Paul, this has been mentioned on the show before, but we've not told the story. Can you just tell me what happened? What did you see, and how did you find yourself in a spot to see it?
Well, I don't exactly remember what time of day. I want to say it was after lunch, maybe 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It had been a pretty casual day, not a whole lot of activity. So typically I was wearing my fuzzy slippers and drinking coffee, eating my beanie weenies and wearing my dry socks. And we heard this extremely loud impact over to the west cabin. Something hit the sidewall, and immediately we reacted, and Brad McAndrews grabbed his rifle and took off in that direction. Says, I'm going to check it out. And, you know, and I'm still kind of gearing up, you know, and really not in the right mental framework to, because this has happened so frequently.
Right.
Rock impacts just happen all the time, almost to the point of regularity where you just don't react that way. So
well, it isn't like the alarm going off in the firehouse. You don't have to jump up and get your stuff because, yeah.
Absolutely. So I finished off my coffee, and he came back 5 or 10 minutes later. And then at this point, Daryl Collier and Bob Strain decide to go off down there. And so I said, maybe I ought to put my pants on and go get involved in the game here, suit up, you know. So I geared up, and I grabbed my rifle, and I walked down the road. And I remember I came around the corner to the clearing, and I saw Bob Strain. He had posted sort of just to the side of the road, and he was looking west down the road. And he was being still and quiet. And so I thought, well, okay, so they're kind of on a stalk or something. So I thought, you know, I'm going to be sneaky, and I'm going to sneak up on Bob, play a trick on him, you know. So I pulled a little Ricky Recon trick, and I just very quietly and slowly put a stalk on Bob, just right in the middle of the road. I wasn't trying to be, you know, stealthy or anything. And so it took me, and the point of the matter is it took me several minutes to kind of get over there. And close the gap to him. And I got probably within maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 yards from him until he finally, I guess he sensed me, and he turned around and he saw me there. And he just kind of acknowledged me, you know, and so I kind of closed in behind him. And as he posted and was looking down west, down the road, I decided to just kind of look down towards the south, towards the creek. And a few minutes go by, and I see movement walking down probably 75, 80 yards to my south. So I immediately think to myself, okay, well, there's somebody down there. I've got something to look at now other than foliage, you know. And a few seconds go by, and I realize there's two large trees at a distance, and in between those trees is a pretty good clearing. And there was sunlight shining down through the canopy at that spot. So I thought, oh, okay, well, whatever, whoever this is, it's walking, I'm going to get a good close visual, you know, sunlight, you know, daylight visual of whoever's walking in my direction.
And at this point, in your mind, it is whoever. It is a person. It's not whatever was walking, and you're thinking it's one of our guys.
Absolutely. I knew that Daryl was down there. I thought maybe Brad McAndrews had gone with him. I really had no idea who was down there. I thought there were multiple.
He just showed up.
Right. I thought there were multiple team members other than Bob. Down in the creek area, just kind of investigating, you know, snooping around. And I thought, well, I'm going to get a confirmation here in about a second, you know, and I'll know who it is. And my rifle was slung. My mental framework was not at all prepared to see a wood ape. I can't really explain why. I guess I'd grown complacent, perhaps. I'm sort of known as the group curmudgeon who likes to... who Monday morning quarterback people that have actually had visuals and had a rifle in their lap. And it's like, why didn't you shoot? You know? So here I am, you know, karma's paying me back. My rifle's slung, and I'm just very nonchalant. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, in about a second and a half, I'm going to see who it is, you know? And about that time, this thing walked, and keep in mind, it's walking towards me, but kind of at a 45 degree angle towards my right. But it's facing me. And it stepped in between those two trees, and I immediately realized it wasn't anybody from our team. And I thought, and what first drew my initial interest was, when I used to bow hunt, I wore these, it's sort of a ski mask type thing, but it's made of that leafy flage material. So it's sort of like a veil. It has a little eye slit, and it has a drawstring at your neck so you can cinch it down. But it has this wild, leafy kind of, you know, a material. And that's what it looked like it was wearing. And I thought, and my first thought was, who in the hell is wearing one of those things? Because I don't recall any of our team members actually wearing that.
In the past, you've described the shape. I mean, and you're doing it in with your hands, but no one can see you. It's like pointy on top. It sort of goes down at an angle down to the shoulders.
Right. It looked like one of those leafy flage, you know, bow hunter veils. But it came to a point it was pointed at the top, and what I recall the most is that the outside sort of a halo effect around it was an orange color, like an orange brown, almost like an orangutan type color. And I thought, and I remember, and all these thoughts are flooding into my brain, you know, as it's happening. And I'm thinking, that's really odd. I don't recall, you know, I'm thinking to myself, I don't recall seeing, you know, a hunter's veil that looks like that or looks in that color. And then the pointed sort of almost a cone-shaped head, you know. And I thought, and all these things are flooding into my head. I'm like, that doesn't look right.
Here's what I love about this. You're in Area X, right? And you see a pointy-headed cinnamon colored thing off by the creek, and you're still not thinking Bigfoot in your head. You're still not like, that's not a monkey. That's like, who's that guy? This is what I love about this.
Well, and I'll tell you why here in a second too. And as for the rest of it, it looked like it had on one of those sort of like one of those Under Armour shirts. Uh-huh. That it was like a solid, maybe an olive drab or a dark kind of a greenish brown color, and then the sleeves looked like camouflage. Except I noticed on the outside edge of the arms, on both arms, it had that almost like of a brownish orange halo effect.
This is from sunlight.
Yes, correct. And I only saw it from the waist up. And this thing, you know, its arms were swinging. It was very casual. And it almost, and I've described it to people, but it looked like, as this, but it looked like, it reminded me almost of Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. He's just kind of diddy bopping back on the block, you know, shuffling back, like very, very casual, very, but at the same time, very confident, very a sense of purpose, a sense of comfort, and all these things again, you know, in a time frame of about 2 seconds, are just flooding my brain.
So it's not being furtive. It's just walking. It's just sort of booking along. You're not running, not rushing, not sneaking, just walking.
Right, but it almost had a cat, you know, that ate the canary type of demeanor, like ha ha, you know, I got one on you, bastard, you know, and he's just walking very confidently and casually across, you know, this little clearing, and then it passed in front of the right hand tree, and then I couldn't see past the foliage. At that point, it was totally obscured. And I think I was in shock. I was like, who did I just see? And so I leaned over to Bob and I said, Bob, I kind of whispered. And I said, Bob, who's down there? And he kind of looks over his shoulder at me and he says, well, Daryl's down there. And so my brain immediately searching for answers went to Daryl. And I thought, okay, well, it's Daryl. And so I sat there for maybe, I don't know, 5 or 10 seconds. And I remember thinking to myself, wait a minute, Daryl doesn't wear one of those things. That didn't look like Daryl to me at all. Daryl doesn't wear those types of clothes. And so then I thought, oh, you know, maybe I just saw a damn wood ape. But here's the problem. And this plagued me for about 12 hours after the incident. I literally was expecting all these years, and subsequent to that, the last 3 years, because of the sightings of Old Gray, my mind wanted to see Old Gray, wanted to see Patty.
Right.
And I had sort of pre-programmed my brain to think of a Sasquatch, of a wood ape, to be this massive 8 foot tall, you know, very large frame, bulky, you know, Brahma bull on two legs type creature. And so
Old Gray is this animal that several of us have seen, but it's very large, bigger than Patty, but shaped like Patty, but just gray. And that's what you thought you were going to see. Sort of the classic Bigfoot.
Right. The classic, stereotypical characteristics. That's what I was expecting in my mind. And since I didn't see that, my mind could not immediately accept what I was, what I thought I'd saw. I couldn't go there. So I immediately started filling in all the blanks, trying to figure out, okay, who was that? What was that? What did I just see? What was the deal? And it never dawned on me at the time that, Daryl always carries his rifle with a single point sling, with his weapon at the low ready. He usually wears a boonie hat. And that's just not, none of that stuff really dawned on me at the time.
The significance of the weapon, the way he carries it, is his arms would not have been swinging. They would have been holding the weapon.
Absolutely. This thing had free-flowing, swinging arms, very casual. Like I said, he was diddy-bopping back on the block,
That's not really a word, but I understand what you mean.
Well, it's my word. But and so I thought to myself, okay, so if this person continues at that rate of speed on that same trajectory, it's going to end up on the road just past the fifth wheel trailer probably in about 2 or 3 minutes. So I thought, okay, I'm going to get confirmation one way or the other. And so I remember thinking to myself, okay, I'm going to know if it was Daryl or not here just real quick. And I remember feeling almost a fleeting glimpse of excitement, thinking I may have just seen a wood ape, but I couldn't get there yet.
Right.
Well, about 10 minutes passed and Daryl never showed up nothing showed up to my west. And all of a sudden Daryl pops out to the east on the opposite end of the fence line of this cabin area. And he wasn't wearing his boonie hat. He had a ball cap on, a camouflage ball cap, but clearly, it was not what I had seen. And then I really got pissed. I got mad because I was like, what the F did I just see? What just happened to me? And why does it not fit all these parameters that I had pre-programmed my brain to see, and to process? So Daryl comes over and he's like, guys, I think I just busted two black ones down by the creek. And I said these words. I said, F that, Daryl. What the hell? I said, where were you just now? Where were you? I was mad. I was angry. Where the F were you? And he's looking at me like, what's your problem? And I said, were you down? And I pointed, were you down there? And he says, well, yeah, but like 15 minutes ago. And I said, were you coming this direction? He goes, no, I was going, so we went through this whole thing and he actually went down there and did a reenactment for me. And I told him, he walked down there and I said, stop, right where I saw this thing in between the two trees. And he was, retracing his steps, and he was facing the exact opposite direction that this thing was going, and clearly was not the same thing, and I got to tell you, it literally took me a good 12 hours to process this in my brain, and for Daryl and Brad to just kind of rationalize out, the steps. It's like, look, I didn't have, I had my rifle. My arms couldn't swing. It's rocky. It's rough down there. You've been down there. This thing was walking like it was on flat ground, very effortlessly. And so it was just this constant process, for literally 12 hours. I had to sleep on it. And it was sort of anticlimactic because I literally had programmed myself and expected to see this patty thing, And then afterwards, I tried to get a better description so I could tell people about it. And what came to mind was I remember a drawing, a sketch from one of the I think it was from Green's book, The Apes Among Us, and I think that's where I first saw it. But it was an old sketch of Jacko,
right.
And for some reason my mind went to that sketch, and I thought that's kind of like what I saw.
Right. Jacko being the purportedly supposedly a young ape that was sort of captured by a train crew in British Columbia a whole long time ago. But that's that in your mind, that's what it seemed like to you.
Correct. It's just, and again, it's kind of taken me a while to, and even today, it's almost like the collective experience of this group and individuals of this group over the past several years, the integrity and the friendships and the bonds that I've made with these people, that far overshadows, and their collective experience of this animal far overshadows my own visual experience, to the faith I have in the existence of this animal. In other words, it didn't take this visual to convince me. I'm more convinced by their experiences alone, by what I saw, because it was just so not what I expected.
I didn't see what you saw, but I saw something too last year. And what was interesting to me is what you're saying kind of resonates with me, because you wait, because if you go out looking for Bigfoot, you're trying to see one, right? That's the big prize, right? But then what I found after I saw it, and what I kind of hear you saying, is you're saying, like, oh, that's what it was. You know, it isn't like your life isn't different when it's over. You just keep going. You just keep looking. And I don't know what I'm trying to say, but you sort of expect that once you get this prize, so to speak, something's going to be different afterwards, but it's not really.
No, because you already think that they exist. You already, I hate to use the word belief.
Right.
I don't believe in Bigfoot. I know in Bigfoot.
Right.
And you already have that knowledge. And then when you see one, it's like, oh, yeah. You know, and I do believe that what I saw was a juvenile or a young adult male, only based on the experiences of others. And I happen to think he's one particular individual that we've seen numerous times now after hearing all the stories, but especially because of the location where it was. But it took me a good long while to process all that out in my own head. To come to those conclusions. And of course I got ribbed by everybody. Well, how come you didn't shoot it? Ha ha ha, you know? And I deserve that.
Yeah, you do deserve that, because that's one of the first things you say to people when they have a sighting. But anyway.
Well, I won't anymore, because I get it now. It's because I wasn't mentally prepared. And had I been prepared, if I actually had my rifle at the ready, you know, I'm very confident I could have taken a shot and had a reasonably high expectation of success of hitting it, based on my own experiences and my own confidence and my abilities. But I at the time I thought there were people downrange. I thought there were team members, at a minimum Daryl, but I thought maybe Brad McAndrews had been down there as well. And it just wasn't I just was not in the right frame of mind, and the context wasn't even correct.
Right.
I was still in slow-mo, you know. I just literally got out of my fuzzy slippers.
I don't know that it's a shot anybody would have taken, not knowing where our guys were, because our guys were in that area. So it was not a shot that anyone would have taken, I don't think. But, I do want to know why you didn't shoot it.
Well, that's why, because I thought I was seeing a person. And then, but as your mind processes it, as it's happening, it's almost like your body can't catch up to the reality of what's going on the ground. And your brain is trying to process something that isn't supposed to exist.
Absolutely.
You know, your brain is trying to fill in blanks that don't have blanks.
Right.
You know, there's no reality there to base it on.
So many of the people that I've spoken to in this group who have had their first sighting, and the sighting goes by and their brain keeps trying to shove this peg into different holes, trying to make it fit. And by the time you realize that it's this other hole over here, it's all over. But you're still trying to process it the entire time.
Well, it took me 12 hours to fill that hole eventually. And that's a great analogy. It's like my brain was trying to pigeonhole something that it had never had to do before. And it was long after the thing was gone, you know? I mean, so you can forget about taking a shot, you know? I mean, And I'm okay with that, because you know it wouldn't have been a safe situation anyway. But I'm still kind of shocked, you know, at how it all went down. And I've told people in the group, and I've told people on the forum, you know, our own forum, that look, you got to be prepared. You got to be mentally prepared for something you're not expecting, because I expected Patty, and I did not see Patty. I saw Jacko, you know, and I was not at all prepared for that. So, but I'm firmly convinced that I saw a wood ape. So, you know, I know I did.
So now I'm with two of the members of the NAWAC who spent quite a bit of time in the Overwatch tent. Can you guys introduce yourselves?
I'm Brad McAndrews.
And I'm Jordan Horseman.
So you guys, Brad, you were in there quite a bit, but there was also times you were in there together. So we're just going to basically talk about the general notable activities that you experienced while you were in there. Brad, I was there during Bravo Team when you were there during Bravo Team, and one morning, because it was early in the morning, but it was definitely morning, some interesting things happened. Can you just sort of walk me through those?
Sure. The one event I think you're talking about happened during the second week on site, which we call Bravo Team. The first 2 weeks we had almost every other day, just bad weather, very cold. And the night in question was probably our fourth night in the Overwatch. I believe that's right. During Bravo, and all night long, completely dead quiet. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it was quiet all week long and almost a week and a half at this point. No events all night long. And right around 6:15 after, you know, the sun was probably just rising at that point, but it had been light for approximately an hour. I was in the Overwatch tent with Jeff Eldringham, and he was actually racked out on me. We kind of took some shifts, and he was racked out for about 30 minutes. And I was cold, and I was, you know, it was actually not too unlike how cold it is in this room right now.
Air conditioned. It's very well air conditioned here.
Yeah, it was in the upper 30s, maybe lower 40s. I had a wool blanket around me, and I was actually sitting down. And what we would do every 15 minutes, we sit down and we listen. And you get up, and even if you didn't hear anything, you get up and you'd scan 360 with the rifle and the thermal optic. And I was like clockwork. We did that all night long. About 6:15, I heard some sounds. So I stood up from my chair very quietly and put the rifle on the tripod and started scanning. Did a quick 360. I immediately saw two of the resident foxes, basically a little bit to my northeast, but between the camp, base camp, and the Overwatch tent. And so I just went right past them because we see them all the time. Yeah, 360, I didn't see anything, so it must have been them. So I was just watching them because I was bored. It's 6:15 in the morning, and we were planning on being there till 9 a.m. And while I'm watching them through the optic, all of a sudden I start to hear this. It's just a racket. It's extremely loud. It sounds, the best way to describe it, and it's actually louder than this, but would be like taking, you know, rebar and like metal on metal, like rebar across corrugated tin. Over and over and over, rapping back and forth, very loud, very caustic sound. And I was thinking in a split second, maybe 3, 4, 5 seconds, I'm thinking, what in the heck is this? Is it one of our guys got out of the cabin? Or are they making a racket and I can't hear them? What is this? And these thoughts are very fluid in my mind. Of course, when I'm watching these foxes, they go to attention. They both go from eating some of our chow that we put on these big rocks, and they look directly at that in that direction of the sound, which happened to be to the immediate west of the cabin, so to my northwest.
What's interesting to me about this is it's right outside the window in which I was sleeping, but I did not hear a thing. But it was loud enough. I mean, I trust it was very loud, but I slept right through it, which is, you know, awesome. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, you know how we can sleep out there sometimes after those long days.
You're exhausted. Anyway, go ahead.
So anyhow, so I'm still watching these foxes, and this very loud metal sound happens, and they alert to it. I have still eyes on the foxes, and I hadn't even thought to swing the rifle in that direction yet. While I'm still watching the foxes, I hear a whoop, but, you know, maybe without the P sound. But it was a moderate. It wasn't quiet. It wasn't extremely loud. It was like an exaltation of emotion, just like a whoop. And I was like, I was thinking, that's an ape.
Right.
Holy crap. And I swung my rifle towards the sound where I was hearing it come from. So I swung my rifle in that direction, and lo and behold, there's Brian Brown's truck.
It's a really nice truck, though, isn't it?
It's pretty.
And it's real big.
Unfortunately, that's true. So I'm looking in this direction, and I'm just, you know, I'm biting my lip. Of course, I'm just.
Well, you're cursing me. You're like, guy, parked his damn truck right there.
It's hard to believe that this is actually happening, but it's a whoop. I know what I heard. I've got 2 5-hour energies and a pint full of coffee in me. I'm awake. And this racket keeps on going. I mean, this racket goes for 20, 30 seconds before I hear any other sound. In between there, I heard an agitated fox and the which we now believe is an ape, strongly believe is an ape. A fox is agitated or like it was fighting something, and it sounded like it ran up the mountain, ran up the North Mountain. And at that point in time, it stopped, and then it started again. And then it started to vocalize in what everyone refers to as chatter, almost like a disgruntled, very extremely deep sound to it. And
So this is essentially what is referred to as the samurai chatter. Several of us have heard it over the years. We recorded it a couple of years ago. Are you familiar with the Sierra sounds?
I am. I wouldn't say it's directly the same, but it's pretty darn close. Right. And to hear it at this volume and that depth is it's something else. So when I was listening to this, I was like, I can't believe this is actually happening. Much less that after the whoop, this vocal that I'm listening to, and I'm not talking about a quick vocal, I'm talking 20, 30 seconds worth of it. And I can't believe what I'm hearing. So I turn, my partner's asleep, and I can't see it, so I can't get a shot off. And I'm thinking, all right, I'm going to put this rifle down, I'm going to grab my lever gun, I'm going to get out of this thing while it's making a racket, while it's being loud, and I'm gonna run at it. My lever gun is not in the tent with me. I just didn't think about it at the time. So I'm in there without it, and so this a fascinating thing's happening, and it's still vocalizing. So I turn to Jeff, who's racked out, and I'm shaking him violently. He's not waking up. So I slap him on the face pretty good for four or five times or more. That didn't wake him up. So I knocked him twice pretty. I mean, I'm surprised he never said anything about it, but I knocked him pretty good. And he woke up and I was just like, shh, listen. And he sat up and, I mean, he listened to it for 10 or 15 seconds, clearly. So anyways, when it was doing this, it actually sounded to me as if it was moving to its west and then to the south where I might be able to hear it. Of course, I'm taking my eyes off because, you know, I'm lifting a 7-pound rifle with an optic on it to the direction on a tripod and looking back to him trying to get his attention. So I'm back and forth and I'm trying to get my eyes on it, but I can't see anything. So I'm a little bit defenseless, but in a nutshell, that's kind of what happened. And it kind of dispersed after that, nothing more.
So how long had you, that's basically the punctuation at the end of a very uneventful night. How long does one of these shifts usually last when you guys are in there?
Depends on how long we were up the night before. I'd say anywhere from as early as 22:30 to maybe 2 a.m. the next morning, we will start. Earlier in the summer, I started to try to stay in there until 9:30 a.m. just so that it looked like we literally are sleeping in there. Later on in the summer during Juliet, you know, you're in there and these just fantastic things are happening because, you know, everything accelerated as the summer got warmer and the foliage bloomed. And things would happen in the morning and we're just itching at the bit. So sometimes it'd be 7:30 and I had to get out of that tent and chase after something. I mean, that's just natural. It's just, well, it's not stir crazy. It's just that you want to capitalize on something, and enough is enough. Right. You do understand?
Yeah.
There were times during Juliet where, you know, my partner Jordan Horseman was in the Overwatch with me, and the first night we were in there, as soon as everybody racked out and went in the cabin, we had animals coming down from North Mountain and starting to encircle us, and you can hear them moving very, very loudly, and then we had a rock. I mean, it was a rock, and it was hurled fast, and it came in sideways, and you could hear it coming straight at us, right, and hit, you know, the accordion crossbeam in that sideways. It wasn't a nut falling out of a tree. This is, you know, maybe a baseball to a half a baseball size, pretty good rock hitting us sideways. And
following a huff, there was a huff, and then a rock came in just as you said, and it was absolutely unnerving.
So Jordan, how many times had you done Overwatch up to this point?
That was the second night.
Relatively soon. And how many times had you been down into Area X at this point?
That was the very first time I'd been in X.
So the very first time you get a huff and a rock thrown at your head, basically, inside the tent. So what is, as a relative newcomer to the situation, after hearing a lot of stories, what are you thinking at this point?
Before that, you're thinking, can I possibly bring an outsider perspective to perhaps... You know, sometimes we hear things that sound like apes, but everyone knows they're barred owls. Maybe there's something for other things that are attributed to apes. But so your mind's desperately trying to come up with reasonable ideas, and then something like that happens, and you cannot lie to yourself anymore. It's immediately recognizable what it is, and it's shocking.
How far? I know you guys had some really interesting experiences with rocks over the time that you're in there, but this particular rock we're talking about that hit the side of the tent, how far do you think it traveled?
It's hard to judge. It definitely was not far away.
30 yards, maybe. It wasn't very far.
Yeah.
But it came from a direction where we had large animal movement. Mm-hmm. and sounds. And but that's cupcakes compared to what happened that week.
Yeah, I want to get into that. So later on in that same week, was it? You heard some much more significant rocks being thrown from a distance. Can you just tell me what happened?
This was much later in the week.
Probably the fourth night we were in there,
yeah,
I believe.
About the fourth night. It was later in the night, probably around 4 a.m.
I think our field notes say this took place between about maybe 3:15, and this has been a while since I've been there and looked at these notes. Maybe 3:15 in the morning to about 4 a.m.
We had heard quite a normal amount of wildlife. It wasn't a very quiet night, but we were taking notes, and we heard some rock throws that were definitely unique.
We were a little dumbfounded by this one, and we wouldn't learn really what caused these sounds until 20 minutes later after the first sound that we heard. And so just picture this. You are in a 8x8 black tent where you cannot see. You literally cannot see your hand in front of your face. You heard Daryl talk about it earlier. I mean, when you were in this environment, you have, and we had a cot in there. We had one chair and a tripod with a rifle, various batteries, some other facilities, right? And you have your scopes. We had a monocular and a rifle scope. You have to create a mental map in this environment to look at things. So everything, all your senses are focused on, your sight is gone. Feeling's gone. Your sense of smell is retarded because you are in an enclosed environment.
It smells like a trash bag in there.
Right. So, your sense of sound, you're relying very heavily on it. And the more time that you spend in that type of environment, you can start to kind of triangulate different sounds and get an idea of depth, distance, speed, those kinds of things. So this particular night that we're talking about, we heard, and this is what we wrote in the field notes, what sounded like a series of wood knocks in very quick succession of one another over in a linear type of vector, right? From the northeast of our location, maybe about 55, 60 yards, I'd estimate, from the main cabin, over the in the direction of the cabin and past the cabin, a series of 4 or 5 sounded like wood knocks, clean wood knocks, no other secondary sounds.
4 or 5 over what period of time?
Very short.
2 or 3 seconds max.
Real quick, but you could sense that they were moving along the...
It was very linear. Yeah, it was from one side to the next directly.
So to the LA person's ear, or whatever you want to call us, Bigfooters or whatever. Anybody listening to this stuff out in the woods, listening to noises and trying to apply it to something, right. It sounded like wood knocks, right? And I don't really like to use the word wood knock. I mean, they're just audible signals to me, right? We don't really know what's producing these things. Right. But it sounded like a series of 4 or 5 wood knocks over a period of 2 to 3 seconds, in a distance of about probably 120 yards. And so we just wrote that down, and I said, this makes absolutely no sense. I cannot accept that this is multiple animals making these sounds in quick succession to one another. It doesn't make sense, and I cannot accept it, but these are my notes.
That's a football field, including the end zones.
Right.
And they're not doing the wave, right. So right. What is it?
Right. So 15, 20 minutes later, we are still in there, and we have already whispered this over, and we filled out our field notes in our journal, wrote down our thoughts. And then we had, from that same original direction, what was absolutely a rock throw, and a tremendous rock throw that started from that same location that was northeast of us. But this came to the south and surpassed where we were in the overwatch, I would guess anywhere from 70 to 80 yards. And we're talking like a very large rock just tearing the foliage, the limbs. You're hearing knocking sounds like wood knocks, but this time we can hear foliage. We can hear everything. We hear the rock impact the ground. It was tremendous. And we looked at each other, Jordan and I, and we're thinking, I was like, oh my God. Because here's the deal, right?
That was the most unnerved I was there, because it was the only time I was out there when I realized that Brad was unnerved. So once I realized that Brad was unnerved, I said, okay, all these other times I was getting a little nervous, he seemed to think it was everyday sort of stuff.
I have heard literally hundreds and hundreds of rocks being thrown. Right. Nothing like this. Before we could even, we were mid-sentence talking, we were whispering, but we were unnerved. And, mid quote-unquote sentence, we heard another one, and this comes from our southwest.
So the opposite direction, different direction.
Totally, the origination was much further away. I'd say at minimum 60 yards, at minimum. And when it first started, we could hear it, and it made us stop whispering to one another. And it was distant. It was quiet. But you could hear it ripping foliage and limbs and limbs. And it was very loud. It was producing knocking sounds. It was so fast. Ripped through all, it was basically coming our direction. I think I ducked. I mean, literally, I thought it was coming right at us.
It sounded like it was thrown, but just literally launched by something.
It was like a mortar. It was like a mortar. Literally, that's the best analogy that I can come up with, was like a mortar being launched. And then there was this pause. And then just a couple seconds later, half second later, just a tremendous impact on the roof of the main cabin. Just like a cannon.
The loudest I've heard by far.
And I've experienced a lot of things in this valley. This is the only time that I've actually considered retreating into the cabin. It was completely unnerving. That should say something to you, that a rock being thrown, listening to something like that, could influence me like this.
Well, I think there's sometimes when you're presented with this display of force, this display of power, right? And they're not overly aggressive animals most of the time, and then all of a sudden they do something that just demonstrates this huge amount of strength, and you're just like, holy God, I'm small, right?
Awe. You're in absolute awe of what took place. I'm still in awe of what took place.
So the those initial knocks you guys heard that you wrote down the real quick. Now, do you think that was a rock going through the trees? Is that what you're thinking now?
That absolutely had to have been a large rock traveling 120. I shouldn't even be saying.
I know it sounds crazy.
120 yards. I mean, this thing had to be a softball size. It had maybe bigger. Right. This hit limbs that sounded like wood knocks.
Right. When I first heard it, Brad was the one taking notes, and I was thinking, I want to say, hey, I know this sounds crazy, but do you think that was a rock throw? But I knew, you know, I was still a rookie. I was first time I was in there, and I was thinking, okay, I don't want to be a fool and mention something that's impossible.
You don't want to be the guy saying something stupid like, I think it just threw a rock 120 yards.
Yeah, it sounds so foolish, right. And so I
are the same thoughts that I had, right. But nothing was rational.
So it was a game of truth chicken. Who's going to really say it? Did you hear what I think I heard? Yeah. And I don't know.
What do you think you heard?
It wasn't until the throws that came after we realized, okay, there's confirmation that it's not so insane to believe that's what we originally heard, because we just had example after example since.
I can't recall ever having had that particular kind of event reported. Though back in 2008, we heard some very large sounds of rocks impacting. We didn't hear them flying through the trees like that. But I think this is unique in the 3 years that we've been doing this. Is that correct?
Well, it was unique until the following team after we left during Kilo, where Derek Collier and Travis Lawrence experienced the same thing. And we talked to these guys, you know, just here yesterday, that they were like, you know, we believe our partner's here. But that's just so awesome what they're describing. It's hard to fathom. I mean, what do you think about that? And then that same night when they were having that discussion, they experienced the exact same thing.
Incredible. So was it the same night that you saw something through the thermals, or was that a different night?
The third night we were in Overwatch was, we got in there late because it was Sawbones last night there, and he was just really felt like a lot of tension. He really thought something was going to happen. So he stayed up late, and we stayed up late with him. He was eliciting a lot of responses from the animals, lots of rock throws, but eventually he decided to retire to the cabin, and we got into Overwatch. It wasn't long that we were in there, and we had heard things up on the mountain the whole time, but we couldn't see anything. When we finally got in Overwatch, we both were scanning. We heard loud animals, large animals up on the mountain. And we looked up, and you could see white. You could see something on there, but it was...
White is what it looks like through the thermal. What, yes. The heat is, the hotter it is, the whiter it is.
There was a hot spot, but you could tell, there was multiple hot spots, but you could tell it was being caused by one or maybe two animals, something large, but it was very indistinguishable. So
the foliage is in the way, you might be seeing glimpses of it through the heat through the foliage.
Correct. And Brad's on the actual weapon, and the weapon didn't really have as good of a thermal as I had. And I could see this animal or animals, and I knew it was large, but we couldn't really tell what it was.
Yeah,
so
it was indiscernible. It was amorphous, and it was 60 yards away.
Yeah. And it was very it really got my blood pumping to think this could be, is this what, I mean, it's a bear or it's something else. But, you know, you want to err on the side of caution. And next thing we know, we can't see it again. And we waited a little while and it seemed rather quiet. So Brad decided he was going to take a few winks and rest a little bit. So, and again, we got in there late. So even though we hadn't been in the tent that long, it was very, very late at night. So as soon as Brad lays down on the cot, he starts to snore like it seems like all of us seem to do as soon as we lay down there. And I'm not used to this environment. I'm very nervous. I just saw what I thought could definitely be a strange animal. Best case scenario, it's a bear. So I'm definitely trying to be very trying to make sure I'm not leaving any stone unturned, scanning constantly with the thermal. And I am actually seeing quite a few animals. I'm seeing some small animals, rodents. I believe there was a raccoon that was moving around. So I'm definitely seeing wildlife, but nothing out of the ordinary. And it seemed like as soon as he started snoring, the whole place got active. Nothing strange, but just even normal animals that you'd expect, like the raccoons, they weren't moving around until he started snoring. So I'm scanning and I'm scanning. And just to the southwest, there's a pair of trees, and I see a hot spot just like I did on the mountain, but it's very small, maybe a raccoon, something on the tree. And so I focus on it. There's nothing else there. And I'm thinking, what is that? Is that a... And before I can even complete the thought in my head as, is it a raccoon on a tree? Is it a bear cub? Is it the... It steps out from this tree, and I just felt my heart drop into my stomach because it was so obvious, because I was trying so hard just moments before trying to discern what this anamorphous shape was. And I was, I don't know. And I don't, and it's, and the stark contrast between that shape on the mountain and this clearly knew immediately what this animal was when it stepped out. Right, wake up. And I immediately knew, okay, as soon as I saw it stride, you could see it walking. I could see the shoulder movement. I couldn't see clearly below that because of all the foliage, but from the shoulder up, it was clear that this was an upright animal walking down this game trail to our southwest, heading across towards the east. So I immediately got Brad up, and I remember saying,
he's, there's an ape. Right there. And he's whispering, but it's a loud whisper.
Yeah.
So I get up, and I fell into a deep sleep quickly. And I had done multiple of these nights, and so this is a different week. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, he got me up, and I'm on point immediately. I've got he points in the direction. I have the rifle in that direction. He says, follow the sound.
Of course, I'm having to show him through touch because it's totally pitch black. He can't see anything.
We can't
so
see each other.
I'm grabbing his hand and trying to point to the southwest corner and saying that's where it is. But of course, at this point, we're probably being less than silent, but also it's already moving when I saw it.
I'm probably on it in 2 seconds. I mean, once I was conscious, you know, I was on it probably 2 seconds. It was quick, but.
And this entire time, I have one eye watching this animal walking across, another trying to get him on this animal. I take the thermal down, get the, no, here. I realized, okay, and like he said, I was really impressed. About 2 seconds, he's up, the weapon's on the tripod, and he's in the direction I pointed. But, of course, at this point, I've already watched it travel quite a ways. I'm realizing this weapon is directly to my left, pointing not where it is anymore. I'm trying to fight my clear vision with his fuzzy vision from the thermal on his end and trying to direct him. So I put down my thermal, and as soon as I did, I said, it's traveling this way, and I heard these loud, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. Of course, at this point, I'm not actually watching what it is. I said, well, follow the sound, follow this. Can you not hear that? It's so...
It sounds like footsteps.
Well, yeah, that's what I thought.
So I'm looking at, we kind of picked out some waypoints, really, around the tent. We use that, I don't remember exactly what terms we were using, but basically to give each other non-visual cues to where to look, and he put me on one. So I was there, and I was there in 2 seconds. I couldn't see anything. And when he's saying follow the sound, I followed the sound, and I was going, further away from the southwest to the south, directly due south. And then I put the rifle closer to the ground because I couldn't see anything, and I see two armadillos. I'm like, Jordan, Jordan, it's an armadillo, man.
And I immediately think, again, like I was saying previously, what? Are you sure? Did I really just misidentify an armadillo? I get back on the thermal. I'm looking around. The animal I was watching is gone. I still hear the sound. But that sound I'm associating with the large animal I just saw. Why wouldn't I? And I also look down. No. I see those armadillos. That is not what I was looking at.
So basically, that was all lost in translation. You know, I mean, it's difficult environment. You know, it's my new partner.
Imagine you're pitch black. You're deeply asleep. And 2 seconds later, you're awake and you're supposed to be like sighting this thing in. I can't even, I mean, I'm surprised that you even could get him up, let alone that you could function.
I have to look back and say, you know, just how quickly, I mean, this guy's, he's awesome. He's a good partner. And we had great communication and we were on it. We were on it. And it just wasn't time. It just wasn't the time. And those things happen. It's happened to a number of us. But the interesting part, and I'll let you talk to this, that next morning we went in to replay this to try to get a better idea because, and I believed what he said, what he saw, but we went over it because while we're sitting in the tent at, you know, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., we're not going to hash it out while we're in there. We have a job to do. So the next morning, I'll let you take that, Jordan.
The next morning, we were trying to determine exactly where it was that I saw it. It is rather disorienting to look through a scope. It's basically projecting it, a computer image of what's in front of you, so it's not one-to-one. It's not like looking through, just a circle. It's the scale's a little different, and it's pitch black. So, you know, at this time, I'm thinking, I know for sure what I saw was what I saw. I was like, I need to find where it was. And so when I did, I had Brad go out to where I saw it. And he's thinking, here? And I said, no, it's further east. And when he got to that pair of trees that I saw, he poked out a little bit. And I was watching him on the thermal. And I said, oh, my gosh. One, because that is a mirror of what I saw, but the main difference is I had no clue until I saw Brad in the same position. The size of that animal was so much larger than it originally appeared to me. When I had the sense of scale, okay, so there's Brad. I know his size. I thought that it was a, you know, relatively smaller animal. But
how big do you think it got? What it was?
What did we determine? Over 7 feet. It was more like, right. It was closer feet. To
seven
eight. Seven and a half. Yeah,
minimum 7.5 feet is about what you said.
So what's interesting, and this is going to tie into what Travis is going to say in a little bit, but that area where you saw this thing walk out of was, if people remember the last episode I did on Area X, and we had perceived motion behind my truck, and this time it was parked in a different spot, not where it would obscure Overwatch anymore, but we had perceived over the course of that week activity back there. I heard something step in there. And this is where you saw this thing walk out of, same area.
That's correct. And it was just very, very,
That was your first sighting, right? That's your first.
It was definitely the first visual. I still have never seen one with my plain eye, right. But as soon as I saw him in the same place, my heart dropped all over again. And it was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it's unbelievable. My brain was still trying to accept the images that was sent to it. There's no way, and yet there's proof that what I saw was a large, large animal.
So now I'm talking to Alton again, and Travis this time, and this is an event that this is pretty much the reason why we know that at some point Overwatch is going to work. So, Alton, you are a bit player in this story, but you were also sort of the catalyst of what happened. So I'm going to ask Travis to sort of explain to him the situation. How you'd been in Overwatch at this point, and you'd been there for a little while. What time of the morning did this occur?
This occurred at 3:50 a.m. And let me preface this by saying we've long known that apes like to approach tents. We've had other experiences that have been talked about here on this show. With Daryl and Alton in the Big Thicket, where one of these animals approached their tent, and we have many sighting reports of these animals approaching tents. It's just something they do. So we decided to try something where Alton would sleep out in a tent, and we could watch over him from the Overwatch. And during this time, occasionally whenever he would wake up during the night, he would turn his light on, and he would play with the zipper on his tent, things like that. And we could see him turn the light on from inside the Overwatch tent because it's very thin plastic that's going around it. And a week before this incident that we're talking about, I was in the Overwatch tent with Daryl, and we saw Alton's light come on. So naturally, as soon as his light comes on, what we would do is scan around with the thermal because we're thinking, you know, if there's an ape nearby, maybe it would start moving because he would scare it away, or maybe it would want to get a better look at him. I don't know. We just that's a natural time to scan. And during this time, I saw a big heat signature not far from his tent. I mean, it's like 15, 20 yards away. It was obviously a large animal, but I didn't see enough of it to identify what it was. And I just saw a piece of it in the brush and, you know, maybe like 5 seconds and then it was gone. And I could tell that it was a large animal based on what I saw, but, you know, I couldn't identify what it was because I couldn't see enough of it. It was obscured by brush. And
I want to stop for a second and say now where Alton, where your tent was in this area that Jordan had seen the animal step out of. It was where during Foxtrot, I had heard something step back in there, and a few of the other members of that team had seen eyes shine in that area. We're really quite confident that this particular area, right where your tent was, is an area where they have been possibly observing us. So you're in your tent at this point, and just tell me from your perspective what happened.
Well, I was in the Area X this summer, 31 days, and the vast majority of those days or those nights I slept in the tent about 100 feet away from the cabin. And on this particular night, I remember when I had entered the tent, I heard some rock movement, rustling sounds, not super loud, but real distinctive rock movement sounds from the little road that is not far away, just, I don't know, 20 feet or so away. And I thought it was Travis, maybe over there. I didn't call out to them. I almost did. I almost called out, what are you guys doing over there? But I didn't say anything. Later found out that it wasn't them. So in retrospect, I was thinking that not long after I'd entered my tent, maybe one of these creatures had come over. Because this area, like you said, we've had over the years, over the summers, the last few years, several sightings in that area. So that was the idea. I was going to sleep in my tent and see if that would attract them. And periodically through the night, because I snore when I sleep, and we were thinking maybe that might serve as an attractant. Through the night, periodically, I would run my zipper back and forth because it makes a pretty loud noise. I turn on my light, stir around a little bit, and just to see if that would, you know, instigate some kind of movement. And so on this particular night, it was about 3:50, I think Travis said, and I was doing that, and that's when he saw something.
So you had first seen some large heat signature. Did you ever get a better look at what was in there?
Yeah, I did. So I saw a heat signature back in the same area the week before this happened. So every time Alton would get up, and I've been doing Overwatch every night ever since then, so, you know, 6-7 days later, and I would always check this one area. There's like a little clearing back in the brush where it just looks like large animals move through and things like that. And every time Alton would get up, I would make sure I checked that spot. And this time I checked that spot, and I saw movement of something like a large animal back in the brush in there. And I couldn't tell what it was. It was up very high is what I could see. And I wasn't sure what it was, and I was in the Overwatch tent with a guy named Robert Taylor. And as soon as Alton turned his light on, I would always say, Robert, okay, you know, scan around. And as soon as Alton turned his light on, I said, shit, Robert, there's an ape back there to the side of Alton, back where it was before. And Robert had a handheld thermal. I had the rifle, and he was training on that area, and he said he couldn't see anything in there. And I was like, I just saw a flash of a big animal back there, you know, as soon as Alton's light came on, like it scared it or something, like it stood up if it was standing back there. I don't know. I said, there's a big animal back there. And I'm pretty sure it's an ape because of how big it was. And about that time, Alton started playing with the zipper on his tent. And, you know, he still had his light on. And I was still staring back in this area. And back in this exact same spot, I saw a head and shoulders come up in the foliage. And, you know, I got to tell you, doing this in the Overwatch with sort of acting like a human bait with Alton, safety is of the utmost importance to us. And I was kind of nervous about doing this because, you know, you have the questions about, you know, shooting something that you can't actually see details of. All you can see is a white heat signature of it. And I got to tell you, as soon as I saw this thing, it looked nothing like Alton. You know, we would, when you look at a human, you can see their clothes, you can see, you know, their facial hair, you can see their hairline of where their skin starts, where their hair ends. You know, with this quality thermal that we've got, it's an ATN Thor, and it's very good quality. And I saw this thing, and it was all I could see was white heat signature. I couldn't see any dark spaces, you know, where maybe there was skin or something. But just the shape of it, there was nothing human-like about it, of its head and shoulders that sort of appeared in the foliage. So I couldn't tell how big it was, but it's just as soon as I saw it, I was, you know, I knew exactly what I was looking at. And within 1 second of seeing it, I put the crosshairs right on this sucker's nose, and I squeezed the trigger. And so I fired, and I wasn't facing exactly towards where it was, because it didn't come out exactly where I thought it would. I was kind of facing a different direction, and I shot it maybe like my 8 o'clock, something like that, and I didn't have the rifle exactly straight on my shoulder because I couldn't from that position. And whenever I shot, the scope came back and hit me in the head, so, you know, I felt like a total noob. Because I got the scope eye, but so the thermal blinked off as soon as I shot because it hit me in the head, and so my next thought was, you know, I got to get the thermal back on because, so I can see what's going on outside, because I'm just sitting in the black now. So I turned.
You want to see the wood ape rip out into pieces?
Yeah, exactly. See the ape rip out into pieces, but so the reason I knew exactly what it was as soon as I saw it, even though it's. You know, it's this humanoid kind of shape, so that's what makes you nervous about doing something like this inside the Overwatch. You know, you can't see color and things like that whenever you're looking through a thermal. But as soon as I saw this thing, just the sheer shape of it, there's not a human on Earth that has this shape. I mean, it had shoulders that, you know, in later comparisons, I could tell that it was very big, very broad. And, you know, I couldn't tell that at the time because it was all I could see. But the top of the head was about as high as it would be on a human, except the head was kind of squished down, like there was no neck at all, and the head was conical. It was come to a pointy top, and the most significant feature that really stood out to me was the trapezius muscles on the side of this thing's neck, you know, or lack of neck, whatever you want to call it. It looked like these muscles came out from about the area of the ear and attached to like the middle of its shoulder. I mean, if that makes any sense at all, there's a picture on our website that's by Pete Travers. It says like Northern Sasquatch, Southern Sasquatch person, something like that. And it's very similar to his drawing. You know, I guess he just got that drawing from Eyewitness Reports. But it had these huge trapezius muscles that connected from his ear to the middle of his shoulder. And his head was pointy on top. So, like I said, his head, the top of his head would be about proportional to where a human was, but his chin would be lower because right. He has a conically shaped head. Right. So it just, there was nothing human about the way it looked whenever I saw it. So
at this point, you've taken your shot at this, you know, sort of classic Bigfoot shape. Your scope has gone off. What do you think has happened at this point? What is going through your mind?
My first thought was, I just did it, you know. And I told Robert. And Robert, actually, from his position, he couldn't see it. You know, the foliage was in the way. I could see, from what I remember, I could see about chest up, and it seemed like all that was clear. I don't remember seeing any foliage in front of him, but you can't pick up real fine foliage through the thermal. But my first thought was, I just did it. And Robert was kind of confused because he's like, I couldn't see anything, you know, and you just shot. So I told Robert, I said, I swear to you, there was an ape over there. I saw it very clearly, and I think we just did it, man. I think it's over because, you know, this thing was about 30, 35 yards from me, and I was right on it. You know, I have a lot of experience as a hunter, and I don't take shots unless I'm 100% positive that I'm going to take an animal. And, you know, not to brag on myself, but I'm batting 1,000 when it comes to deer hunting, you know, except for one incident. But
that wasn't your fault, whatever that was.
It wasn't my fault because the scope was off. But sure. I've killed like 50 deer in my life, and I've never lost one. And you know, it's just, I'm very careful about my shots. I've you know, not taken shots before because I didn't have the shot and lost good deer because of it. You know, that's the kind of hunter I am, though. I'm very careful about my shots, and I was right on this sucker's nose, and he was just, you know, it was a shooting a fish in a barrel. He was just right there. And, you know, I was 100% positive that I was right on him. I had a good trigger squeeze, and, you know, I didn't jerk, anything like that. I was, and it happened so fast, you know, you get something that a non-hunter would not be familiar with is an adrenaline rush that they call buck fever. You know, as soon as you see a big buck or something, your heart rate raises and things like that, and you kind of start shaking if you look at an animal too long before you shoot it. And this happened so fast. You know, as soon as that head came up, I pulled the trigger, and it happened so fast that I didn't even get the adrenaline rush before the shot. So I wasn't even shaking until after the shot. And, you know, after the shot, I was trying to talk to Robert, and he was like, just breathe, man, you know, because I was kind of, you know, because I thought that I'd just done it. I thought that we had achieved our goal, you know, our present goal.
They actually waited for a while, and Robert instructed me. I was in my tent, and Robert instructed me to go to the cabin.
We actually forgot about Alton for a minute.
I hollered at them. I said something. I don't remember what I said, but what's going on or whatever. Robert told me to go to the cabin and get Mark. Mark slept through the whole thing. So I ran back to the cabin, and we waited a little while, I don't know, 5 minutes or more. And then we went looking for it, and Travis was confident. I mean, he was 100% confident that he had shot one.
So you walk over there, and what'd you find?
Yeah, and I was also 100% confident that it would be piled up in a heap over there, because this wasn't the type of shot where you go like, let me see if I can find some blood so I can find a trail. No, I was aiming at this sucker's nose because I didn't want him to run anywhere. I mean, you know, I didn't know how big he was, and, you know, he was fairly close to the cabin area where we could have just dragged him out. I wanted him to drop right there and be dead, you know? And I was positive that that's what was going to happen. And we gave it about 30 minutes, I think, give or take, I don't know, something like that. You always wait a little bit before you follow up on an animal, because the last thing you want to walk up on is a wounded animal. And even, you know, worse than that is a wounded ape of some sort that weighs like 800 pounds. That doesn't sound like fun at all, right? But, you know, just by the off chance he wasn't dead, we wanted to give him enough time. So we gave him about 30 minutes. It was probably about 4:15, 4:20, something like that. We walked over in the woods right where it was, started shining the lights around. You know, I actually went back to the cabin. We discussed our plan of action. You know, we're going to get we have a sort of a burlap tarp that we were going to drape over it because we have some contingencies, you know, some questions that we don't know how the other apes are going to react whenever we put one on the ground. So our plan was to cover it up with this burlap tarp so that if there are any other apes that can see what we're doing, they won't know what we're doing because they can't see, you know, this member of, you know, their clan or whatever, their troop.
So basically, all of the contingency plans that we've established, you guys are putting into motion at this point. You're about to sort of execute the plan.
Yeah, we are about to execute our plan like you know, exactly as we planned it. So, you know, I went back to the cabin. I switched out the thermal scoped rifle with my 45-70 with my flashlight mounted on it. And we went over to the woods where it was. And, you know, much to my surprise, there was nothing there. And that didn't make sense to me at all. And so I was very confused about that. And, you know, I went back to the Overwatch tent and, you know, I looked, you know, back where Alton's tent was and back where this thing was off to the side. And I was like, yeah, I'm positive it was right back there. And I couldn't understand why it wasn't dead back there because I knew that I was right on it. So I was like, well, you know, maybe somehow that thermal scope, maybe the zero got knocked off on it or, you know, I don't know. You know, we'd shot it like maybe a week earlier and it was dead on. So, you know, sometimes things happen, scopes get bumped and they get knocked off, but I didn't know what had happened, how I'd missed this thing. It seemed like so unlikely that the scope would get bumped because I was the one that had been controlling it and I knew that I hadn't dropped it or anything like that. So it didn't make any sense to me how this ape wasn't dead back there. And, you know, in going back there, I realized it was a little bit kind of back in the brush because it was obscured. And, you know, we looked for like 10 minutes and, you know, Mark is with us and he has a lot of experience hunting and tracking and things like that too. And he said, he pretty much called it. He said, look, dude, there's too much stuff back here between the ape and sort of the edge of the clearing, sort of between you and the ape. He said, you probably hit a twig or something and it deflected the bullet. He said, sometimes you can hit a twig and it can come off at a 40-degree angle and you probably missed it totally. And I wasn't satisfied with that because, like I said, I couldn't see any foliage between me and the ape, you know, other than, you know, what was obscuring his lower portions.
Travis thought maybe the plastic had caused the bullet to deform or something. So we tested that out the next morning.
Up to that point, we had not shot through the plastic, and it's possible that even that small amount would really change the ballistics of a projectile. But you tested that the next morning. That wasn't the problem. You were still dead on through the plastic.
Yeah, we did, and that was sort of our mistake. You know, before we even tried this Overwatch idea, I knew that we needed to test shooting through the plastic, but we just kind of forgot about it because we got so much other stuff going on. So that was sort of our bad for forgetting to test shooting through the plastic and making sure that, you know, the bullet wouldn't mushroom as soon as it hit the plastic and or deflect off in some direction. And we did test it the next morning and found out that I hit a can at 40 yards on my first shot. And so it was a little bit farther away than where this animal was. And so I knew that the gun was on and that there wasn't any problem shooting through plastic. I knew that the bullet wouldn't mushroom going through plastic because the entrance hole into the can was the same diameter as the bullet that I shot. It was a 30-06. But we didn't find anything that night, like I said. And Mark said, you know, let's just wait till morning, wait till it gets daylight. You know, it's only like another hour or so till daylight. And I was very upset because I just couldn't understand what happened because I knew that I was right on this thing. I knew I had a good trigger pull, and somehow this thing wasn't dead over there. And I was very upset about that.
A lot of this sounds to me like the so-called Echo incident from Operation Endurance when Daryl had his shot. And he, you know, in my speaking to him, he's saying a lot of the same things you're saying right now. You expected there to be a pile of dead animal over there, and there wasn't, and it was really sort of pissing you off.
Yeah, it was not so much pissing me off, but just confusing because I wasn't mad. Like, I didn't feel like I'd screwed up or I didn't feel like, you know, maybe I missed. I just didn't understand because I felt like I was right on it. But obviously, you know, I looked, Mark kept saying, let's just go back in the cabin and wait till daylight. And I was kind of out there by myself. And, you know, I was like, I know this thing got to be back here somewhere. I was like, maybe it wasn't standing where I thought it was. I don't know. But I just kept looking for it. And then I realized that, you know, we weren't going to find this thing. It had gotten away. Obviously I'd missed it and I couldn't account for that. And, you know, everybody else just kind of went to bed. I was like, I'm not going to bed. You know, I'm all keyed up now. I was like, I'm not going to bed. And I just kind of, you know, something we do sometimes is just go yell at the mountainside, yell at the apes, just kind of vent. And I walked behind the cabin, and I don't even think I was yelling. I was just talking, and I just sort of told the apes that I said something like, I had you. You know, I saw you, and I had you, and you got touched by an angel because I was on you, and somehow you got away, and I don't know. And, you know, eventually, like 30 minutes later, sort of my adrenaline rush wore off, and I went ahead and fell asleep probably, you know, 6 o'clock or something like that. And I got back up a couple hours later, and, you know, all of us went back to the area of where this happened, and we found a twig right on the edge of the brush, like, you know, maybe 6 or 7, 8 yards from where the ape was standing. We found a twig that was broken, and it's a little twig. You know, it's like half the size of my pinky finger, but it was snapped off, and it was just kind of hanging there by a thread. And Mark went up to it, and he kind of twisted it around to where, you know, where to its initial position, and folded it back up on the tree, and you could see this little half-circle cup shape on the top of this twig, where obviously the bullet had struck this twig, like, and it cut a little cup shape through it. And about 4 or 5 feet behind this twig, there was another twig that was a little bit bigger that was the same thing. It was just kind of hanging there, and if you picked it back up and reset it in its original position, there was a cup shape on top of that one also. And this was maybe like 5 or 6 inches higher than the first twig. So as soon as I saw that, I realized immediately what had happened. I had hit a twig right there at the edge of the brush on the top of the twig, and the bullet had deflected upwards because in a distance of 5 feet, the bullet had risen 5 or 6 inches, and then it clipped another twig, 5 feet later, and it hit the top of that twig also, and it deflected higher up, and I probably shot 2 feet over this animal. So, you know, I was thankful that I knew what had happened. I was thankful that we didn't have a wounded animal out there somewhere. You know, that's the last thing you want. It's for you to wound one of these things and it run off somewhere and die. I mean, that's the worst of all situations. And so I was thankful that I didn't hit it, you know, knowing that I didn't hit it, and thankful that, you know, now I know what happened. I hit a twig, and, you know, we learn from our mistakes. And several.
Basically, we're talking about a quarter of an inch, right? I mean, this is what we're, this is how big this thing was. A quarter of an inch is what made the difference in this particular case. So before you go on, you guys had done some measurement when you found the twig to try to estimate the size of this animal out. What did you find when you sort of took a line from the tent, from the hole in the plastic to this twig, to try to determine the height of the animal?
Yeah, I just did some basic math. I measured the height. You could see the exit from the overwatch tent, of course. It actually blown out quite a large area just from the force of the blast, but you could see the exit hole. And I just measured the distance, the height above the ground, the distance to the first twig, the height of the twig, and the height of the other twigs, and went back to where I thought the creature was probably standing. You know, there was a, you know, an opening back there where we think it was, and you know, you can see where things weren't standing or couldn't stand, and so there was this opening back there, and so I kind of didn't see any tracks, but I estimated you could see probably the route that it took. The road that I mentioned earlier, where I heard some rocks move, on the other side of that's a trail where we're pretty sure that these things traverse. And right immediately across from the road from that trail is where it apparently had entered and found this little area where it was observing my tent. So estimating where it stood in there and estimating the rise of the bullet, and then the distance from the twig to where I thought it was standing, I could estimate the height. And I came up with an estimate of over 8 feet in height.
8 feet, 3 inches, or something like that.
So, yeah. So, and to someone who doesn't know a lot, you know, I've said this before on the show and in other places, but people who don't know anything about firearms think that all guns are guns, right? And they're all doing the same thing. But there's many different attributes depending on the kind of bullet that you're shooting. Now, why did we choose the kind of round that you were shooting that day, and how do you think it played into what happened here?
Well, like I said, we try to learn from our mistakes here, and our mistake here was that, you know, we hit a twig instead of an ape. And so we try to think, you know, it was sort of outside of my control because I couldn't see that twig that I shot at. But, you know, it's something that I didn't account for ahead of time is, you know, what if it's back in the brush somewhere? And you hit some brush, you know, your bullet needs to be able to plow through it. And like we've said, we have this thermal mounted on a 30-06. I carry a 45-70 whenever I'm out is my main gun out there. But we have this thermal mounted on a 30-06 because ATN told us that the 30-06 was the highest amount of recoil that this thermal scope is rated for. So that's the reason we got this 30-06. So it's a little bit weaker, but you know, it's the most powerful thing that we can successfully mount this thermal on, according to ATN. So that's what we did.
Basically, what you're saying there is that if we'd used a higher caliber round, a bigger bullet, so to speak, it would have thrown off the sensitive equipment inside the scope, and you only would have had it would have been impossible to even sight it because you have to shoot it to sight it, and every time you shoot it, you're throwing it off.
Yeah, I don't know if it would have thrown it off or if it would have broken something inside. Right. You know, ATN just told us that they wouldn't recommend us putting it on a 45-70, so we took their word for it. So we mounted it on a 30-06, and you know, in searching for a round for the 30-06, I picked out the round, and it was sort of my bad. We just said, you know, we want the most powerful round we can get because you know, this is a big animal, and we don't want our choice of round to be the difference between an animal getting away wounded or dying. And so we chose buffalo boar. A lot of us carry buffalo boar in our pistols and in our long guns, and I chose the Barnes triple shock tipped X bullet. It's a 180 grain round. It flies at about 2,900 feet per second. It's like a 30-06 Magnum. It's a Spitzer shaped bullet. It's got a pointed tip, and it's an all copper round that expands to about 60% of its initial diameter, and it's made for deep penetration in heavy bones and things like that. Right. And I thought that would be the perfect round for our purposes. You know, it's the Barnes triple shock is a great bullet. And that's what I chose. And, you know, in later reflection, I didn't account for shooting through heavy brush because that's not something I normally do. You know, if that had been a deer back there, I wouldn't have taken the shot because, you know, it wasn't a clear shot and I would have seen that things were in the way, you know. But when you're looking through a thermal, you can't account for that because you can't see it. And so, you know, we're going to change the bullet that we have in that 30-06. You know, I think next time we're going to go with probably a 220 grain bullet that has a rounded tip. The 220 grain bullet in a 30-06, I think, goes at about 2,400 feet per second, something like that. If you have a bullet that's moving slower, it's going to deflect less whenever it hits things. And also, since the bullet is heavier, the 220 grains, it's going to plow through things at and not deflect as much. So it's heavier and it's moving slower, so it's not going to deflect as much. So
basically, the round we had, you can think of it as like a little missile that just that little bit of a twig interaction was enough to throw it off course. But what we're shooting now is going to be some just more of a you know, slug that's just going to go through that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it is going to be a slug, and that's going to be sort of our main setup next summer. And ideally, we'll raise the funds that we can buy another thermal scope, and I want to be able to mount it on my 4570, but not sight it in. On my 4570, I have a Picatinny rail and an aimpoint scope, and I can buy a special mount from LaRue that raises the aimpoint scope, and I can use the thermal in conjunction with it and use the red dot on my aimpoint is my zero, and just turn the reticle off on the thermal, and that way I don't have to sight it in. That way the recoil of the 4570, you know, it'll only be felt once, you know, if I have to shoot one of these animals, if I get that opportunity again. So ideally that would be our second gun. The 4570 would be far better than any 30-06 round because I can shoot a big 350 grain bullet that's moving at 2,000 feet per second, and it's going to deflect much less. It'll punch right through the foliage without hardly any deflection.
Well, as you say, we learn, right? That's what this has all been about. I mean, 3 years now, we're just learning every time we go out there. And this is, you know, what strikes me is that, and I said this to Daryl at some point right after this happened, you know, because there was a sense of disappointment in the group because it was a very close call. But what the positive that I found out of it is that now we have come to a point where trying to collect this specimen is like hunting any other animal. We know how we're going to do it, right? And sometimes the animal, you know, like you said, it gets touched by an angel. Sometimes the luck goes the animal's way, and sometimes it doesn't. So it just, to me, it's just opportunity. Next time we just need another opportunity to do it again, and it's going to happen. Well, I appreciate you telling me this. This is kind of a big deal. So I appreciate you spending the time with me, and just, you know, thanks for everything you've done out there.
Yeah, you know, I'm doing all I can, and like you said, sometimes the apes do get lucky, and, you know, much to our chagrin, they do seem to get lucky. But you posted something on the forum the other day, and it was a quote that said, how did it go? That which is possible is inevitable. Yeah. I think that was the quote. And it's just a fantastic quote, and, you know, we know that our goal is possible. You know, I had one of these animals in my reticle. You know, there's not I don't know if many people on Earth can say that. I had one in my reticle, and I sent a round at it, and, you know, this sort of freak thing happened. I don't know if you call it a freak thing, but something outside of my control happened, and the animal got away. But, you know, it's inevitable. It's going to happen. We're going to do this. You know, we're going to get opportunities like this again. We're going to stick with it, you know, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to learn from our mistakes, and we're going to hone our skills, and we're going to try to make sure that doesn't happen again. Next time, hopefully, you know, we'll get our specimen. It's going to happen.
We all know the lessons of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, right? The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, or the one. You know, never mind what happened in Star Trek III and IV, but seriously, that's the way the members of the NAWAC see the question of collecting a specimen. That one animal, the holotype, can serve to protect and extend the existence of all wood apes all across the continent. Their passion in this endeavor is fueled by 3 years' worth of firsthand experiences and interactions with these animals. As amazing and hard to believe as that may be, there is no doubt among the NAWAC. The apes are real, and they're there. They live in some kind of social group. They're territorial. And as far as the rest of the world is concerned, they're imaginary. They live at the mercy of the clear-cutters and the governmental agencies
who might only view these animals as administrative headaches were they to be proven. We can't know how many there are in the Washitas. We can't know how many there are anywhere. But we know, as a group, for a fact, that they're there. And everyone in the group is committed to the goal of ensuring the rest of the world knows, too.
Yeah, brothers.
I'd like to thank Alton, Daryl, Paul, Brad, Jordan, and Travis for sitting down and sharing their experiences with me and, of course, all of you. Remember, if you get the show through iTunes and like what you hear, please take a moment to subscribe and rate and review the show. It helps listeners find us. Also, as always, you can find more at The Bigfoot Show's website, www.thebigfootshow.com, including some images of the crushed and somewhat smelly Overwatch tent. Also, don't forget our Facebook page, facebook.com/TheBigfootShow. We get most of our ideas from our fans. Now, with that, I shall bring episode 54 to a close. Catch you next time. Bye-bye.
I love that. That's good.